Set it aside. We may need it later. The blood pounding through my ears again, my skull sounding like the inside of a seashell. I blinked hard to try to clear the spots pulsing in front of my eyes. I knew this was the thing to do, but every fiber screamed to retreat and try again some other day, when we had more on our side, when I wasn't so tired, or so nervous, or so fat. I struggled for something to cling to, the way soldiers in foxholes picture their families or a flag. My car, I thought crazily. This fucker crashed the Wongmobile, and for that, he must taste death. It would have to do. I reminded myself to breathe. John pulled up the gate, rolling it up on its tracks with a sound like tank treads. We entered a huge octagon of a room, more storefront blanks where food counters were to go. There was some broken glass and dead leaves on the ground, where one of the panes in the overhead skylight had broken out. Nothing else. John gestured to our left and said, "Check it out." It wasn't a monster, but still I stopped in my tracks, let out a long breath and said, "Shit." There was a painting on one wall to our left. On the wall, on the ceiling, on the floor, on the 2x4 stacked next to the wall. I recognized the style. The painting was abstract, yet strangely realistic. It was a three-dimensional picture of a ring intersecting another ring in a way that seemed to shift as you looked at it. Like the landscape I saw in Robert Marley's bedroom, it seemed to draw you in, to take on complexity as you stared. "It's a picture of time." I tore my eyes off it and said to John, "I think your Jamaican friend was here." "I think he was actually living here." He nodded toward a nearby nest made up of an ancient sleeping bag and about half a dozen plastic milk crates. The surrounding floor looked like the aftermath of a bloody battle between empty Captain Morgan bottles and faded candy bar wrappers. I thought about Wexler, ranting about hidden doors. Now here was where our guy, our patient Zero, had set up camp all those months ago. I felt like there were dots that I was intentionally not connecting. I wanted to go somewhere warm and bright to think about all this. Or, even better, not. I wandered out to the center of the floor, crunching glass and leaves underfoot. John lit up a cigarette and said, "Man, if you could flood this place in the winter and let it freeze up, you'd have a kick-ass place to play hockey." A shriek from behind me. Chrissy, screeching my name. A shotgun blast split through the air. I spun, scanning the room through the sights of the automatic. John screamed my name, bellowing instructions I couldn't make out. Then I saw it, the black shape zipping through the air, like a hefty bag blown around in a hurricane. I spotted it, lost it, caught it again, then it vanished. I spun around. No sign of it. John and Chrissy were staring at me, horrified. "It's okay. I'm okay. Where did it go?" I was okay, now that I thought about it. Felt great, in fact. The adrenaline must have been working, because all the fear evaporated in an instant. A veil lifted from over my thoughts. John and Chrissy, 2 of 6 billion humans on the planet. One American, I heard, consumes enough calories to keep 40 African children alive. John routinely burned half a gallon of gasoline to get a pack of cigarettes. The girl bought special shampoo for her dog while Somali children starved. She warded off her guilt with a gold symbol around her neck, the intersecting strips of gold the last thing millions saw before their limbs were ripped from their bodies in medieval torture machines. 2 locusts, standing before me, blazing through resources by the ton. I had been such a fucking fool. Dave? John dragged me here for one reason. His attention span demanded new and loud experiences, links to add to his chain of distractions until the day he would finally drink himself to death. And the girl? I could save her life 12 times over in this room, and she would still climb into bed with the guy with the great eyes and the promising TV career. She could never contaminate her precious genetic material with mine. When was I going to stop letting the world bleed me dry? Dave, can you hear me? Without a word, I took a step toward the pair. I kicked something metal. It was a rusty utility knife, an inch of blade protruding from the end. I stuffed it in my pocket, thinking I would need it later. The gun aimed non-threateningly at the floor by my side. I strode toward the girl and was pleased to see a look of crippling fear ooze into her eyes. an expression that broke those sculpted porcelain features like a hammer. "Have you ever been truly scared of anything, Princess?" I had a second to look over Chrissy from the neck down, those perfect thigh muscles, soft curves under softer skin, the hint of perfect little breasts hiding under the sweatshirt. I suddenly had an idea for this girl that would win my dick the Nobel Prize. Footsteps. John, running toward me. I spun, raised the gun, shot him in the head. He tumbled forward, spray of blood droplets arcing through the air as he fell face first onto the floor. I moved toward him, but put a second and third and fourth round into his brain. Movement behind me. Pop. Pop. Bzz, pop. 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 Pain. A crackling sound, like popcorn. Every muscle in my body first clenched, then went slack. The tiled floor rose up and smacked me in the face. I lay there, plywood pressed against my cheek, a bug's eye view of the world. I was paralyzed, my brain scrambled. Looks like Chrissy needs new shoes. Hey, look, a smashed cigarette butt. I felt the gun twist out of my fingers. With a huge effort, I turned my head enough to look up and see Chrissy holding the gun on me while she inspected John. He shifted and moved, sitting up. He took off his flannel shirt and pressed it against a wet wound on his scalp, his hair matted with blood. She helped him to his feet. They towered over me, Chrissy with the taser in her hand. I strained to move a limb. Random muscles started to flex under my command again, but I couldn't organize them. John, bloody rag pressed to his skull, looked me right in the eye. "David, if you're still you at all, you know why I'm doing this. Are you in there?" I met his gaze. I tried to talk, tested a few words to get my lips moving. "John? John, I understand, and I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me just now, really, but I'm thinking clear now. It's me. Don't let her shoot me, okay?" He studied my face. I grasped the situation with growing horror. "John," I said, eyes pleading. "Please." All I needed was for him to turn his back. I had the utility knife. Just hide it in my hand, and with a quick and decisive move, I could slit his throat. Use him as a shield, get the pistol away from the girl. After that, then she'd do whatever I wanted under the barrel of a gun. Everything would be fine. John took Chrissy aside. They whispered to each other while she kept the gun on me, the barrel tipping up and down in her delicate hand. I tried to move my legs. I could feel them, but couldn't make them obey me. I ground my teeth so hard I felt like they would shatter. Gotta stay cool. I couldn't hear, but the girl was doing all the talking now, the bitch trying to convince John to do something. He finally agreed and came back to face me. "Dave, here's what I think. I think the thing that was in Wexler was in you. Maybe it still is, maybe it isn't. Now we're going to do something here. Chrissy's going to give me the gun and I'm going to put it on you. It's nothing personal. And on top of that, she's going to press the zappy thing against your skin while she does this. So do not move. You know I won't kill you, Dave, but you jump or grab for her or anything, she'll zap you and I'll shoot you in the thigh. Then I'll come over there and kick you in the crotch. Repeatedly." I showed no emotion. Just nodded. "Get the arms moving, get them moving now. You get the taser away from the girl and immobilize John with it. Move, move, move." Feeling rushed into my right arm. I could flex the muscles all the way up. I was sure I could get it to respond. I focused everything on readying the limb for a quick, violent move. A chop to the throat, make her drop the taser. Chrissy handed the pistol to John. She came around me, pressed the taser against my shoulder with her left hand. With her right, she reached around her neck and took off her gold necklace, the one with the dangling cross. "What the?" She dropped the necklace over my head at the exact moment I swung my fist. My stomach clenched, my hand frozen in midair. "It's poison. They've coated it with some kind of toxin that can seep through my skin like a nicotine patch, into my bloodstream, eating through my lungs and liver like acid." I thrashed away from her and got my hands up, but my coordination was even more screwed now than from the taser. I fought like a toddler, my body convulsed, organs thrashing around inside like they were making a jailbreak from my gut. I fell, hard. Hands on my arm. Soft hands. The girl. Everything stopped. The seizure, or whatever the hell it was, ended abruptly. I was tired, confused. I blinked, trying to take in my surroundings. I sat up and saw the girl stumbling as if she had been cracked over the head with a pipe, dazed out on her feet. She bent down at the waist, breathing hard. She vomited on the floor. I felt like doing the same. I had this greasy feeling like I was rid of something unclean, like I had just passed a tapeworm. And there was this lingering sick shame, the feel of a man who sobers up just enough to realize he's been making out with his best friend's mother. John stared at Chrissy, terrified. He turned on me, questioning, suspicious. "What are you looking at me for?" I shouted. "Go help her, you ass." John nodded, apparently convinced that I was fine. Chrissy was not fine. Chrissy was screaming. She went to her knees, then thrashed onto her back. I scrambled to my feet, moved toward her. John grabbed my jacket, holding me back. "No," I screamed. "It's in her. The thing is in her. Let me touch her. Let it pass back into me, and then shoot me in the temple." "Not today." "It's killing her." "No, it's not. She's killing it." "What?" Chrissy looked up at us with eyes that had turned bloodshot pink, sweat-soaked hair hanging down in strands. There was a deep, black hatred in that stare, so profound that it was like a punch in the gut. I had never seen anything approaching that look on a human face before. The intelligence behind it was so hateful it was alien, unfeeling, unreasoning, infinitely terrible. "I serve none but Korok, a blue eye in the darkness. He controlled you just like the cockroaches." I wanted to curl up into a fetal position and start sucking my thumb, let my tears and dripping saliva pool under me. "Sorry. I tried living, tried being sentient. Can't do it. Can't live in the same universe with that." She screamed again, loud. Opera singer loud, impossibly loud. She clutched at her hair and pressed her eyes closed. A sound erupted in the air around us, a long roar like an ocean wave crashing against a dock. Flecks of glass smacked me in the cheek. 100 panes of glass skylight exploded at once, a circular wave of airborne shards overhead, spreading like a ripple in a pond. Glass poured down around us, a high-pitched ringing as shards pelted the floor, raining down on our heads and shoulders. Silence. She lay still.
"Whoa. She's dead. No. Chest moving. Breathing."
"Move! Move!" John pulling at my sleeve, lifting Chrissy to her feet. A metal beam crashed down behind her. The room was coming apart. We ran, half dragging her out of the food court. Ceiling trusses and light fixtures and cables and boards and glass came down in an avalanche. We tumbled through the gate and into the hall, falling on our asses. The entire food court ceiling collapsed behind us, debris piling in front of the door, a wave of compressed air and dust rushing past us like a sandstorm. Chrissy tried to sit up, looking utterly exhausted. She wiped grit from her eyes. I took the necklace from around my neck and handed it to her. She took it without hesitation, put it on. "She broke it," John said. "Like a fever. It passed from you into her. But it couldn't live in her." He turned his attention to the girl. "How do you feel?"
"Like I could sleep for 1,000 years.
My bullet had creased John's scalp, and he said he was okay, but damn did it bleed a lot. The wad of shirt he held against it was soaked. We wandered around the mall looking for Molly and any additional monsters. Nothing, on both counts. Chrissy stayed with Wexler, calling for an ambulance on her cell. She insisted he was alive, though we could see no sign of it. Then, as the first sirens faded in from the distance, Wexler climbed into consciousness long enough to smile at Chrissy, brush a strand of hair out of her face with his fingers. He said something to her that we couldn't hear, and wasn't any of our business anyway. Paramedics arrived with many, many questions. John told them the truth, and I mean he literally told them I was possessed and that killing the demon destroyed the food court. He refused treatment. After the ambulance left, we made our way out to Chrissy's car. She asked John, "Are you going to get your head looked at?"
"Nah, it's just a cut. I was going to shave my head anyway." "Are you going to go see Danny in the hospital?"
"Yeah, but there's something I'm supposed to do first. He asked me if I had watched the tape. Do you know what that's about?"
I said no, and John said yes simultaneously. "The video he was shooting," John said, "in his apartment."
A half hour later, Chrissy sat down on the couch in Wexler's apartment while John rewound the tape and let it play. Wexler, looking tired and beaten, appeared on the screen as before.
"Hi, honey. Are you there? Answer me if you're there."
Chrissy looked at us, confused. We had no answers. She turned her eyes back to the screen, waiting.
"Come on. It's okay. Just say hello."
Hello, said Chrissy, looking embarrassed. A tear ran down her cheek.
"Danny, you look awful."
"I know. It's been a rough couple of weeks," Danny said, replying to the camera a full 3 hours before Chrissy made that comment.
"Baby, I've done something really stupid. I've gotten wrapped up in something, something you can't imagine."
"What?" said Chrissy, sobbing. "What did you get into?" "If I told you the details, you would wish I hadn't. But you know by now that I'm not myself. I come and go. And right now I'm fine, but I have to fight for every second of control. It's draining. Baby, it takes so much energy to keep myself on top, on the surface, at the wheel. As soon as I relax, he'll take over. It will take over. And I'll be just a spectator. Helpless."
He broke down into sobs. So did Chrissy, sounding utterly drained. "Are you okay?" he asked, through hitching breaths. "Were you hurt in all of this?"
"I'm fine. I'll be fine. This is so strange.
I don't even know how I'm doing it, any of this. Right now I see things, I hear things across time and space, and..."
"It's better if you can put it out of your head, Chris. It's better to live the rest of your life believing things like this aren't possible. But there's other things I need to tell you. Things I've been wanting to say for a long time. And if I'm still alive, I probably won't have the courage to say them in person. But first..."
Wexler's eyes shifted slightly. A chill ran down my spine. He was looking at me. I shifted to my left a couple of feet, and his eyes followed me. He said,
"You're David Wong?"
"No."
"Say no."
"Yeah, I guess."
"Video conferencing across time? Man, I need pie, and fast."
"I don't know all the details. Things are confused in my mind right now. But you're under the eye. You understand what I'm saying, don't you?"
I found I couldn't answer. My mouth had gone so dry, it had glued shut.
"David, you alone fully understand what is at stake here."
A thousand questions popped into my mind, but all I could do was peel my lips apart and say, "But I don't," before trailing off.
"Chris and I need to have a private conversation now, okay? Glad you made it out alive."
I begged off from John's offer to stay the night at his place and drink many beers with him. I was hungry and had something else to take care of first. I took a cab to McDonald's and had it dump me in the parking lot. I took a deep breath, steeled myself, and approached the sign. I prayed I'd find it back to normal.
Nope. There was Ronald. Cutting himself, gutting himself, eating himself.
I felt something rigid in my jacket pocket and pulled out a rusty utility razor I didn't remember putting in there. I dropped it like it was a rattlesnake, then picked it up with two fingers and threw it in a trash can. I stared down the poster again. I was hungry. The inside of the restaurant was closed, but they did have a 24-hour drive-through. I walked up to it, and shivering in the chill of the autumn air, ordered two bratwurst. I sat on the curb across the parking lot, and looking right at the sign the whole time, ate them both. Arnie rolled to a stop in the weed and dirt field that would have been the mall parking lot had they ever gotten around to paving it.
"So," Arnie said, "Christian mints, crosses, Bibles. This whole long story is just an elaborate setup to get me to subscribe to guideposts, isn't it? You're going to leave me with pamphlets and pictures of Jesus, then go start telling this whole story to the next sinner? Got to be less roundabout ways, Wong."
"Nope. That stuff, the crosses and all that, either it works because we think it works, or because the bad guys think it works. Or maybe there's some power everybody can tap into if they just know how.
It's Scientology, isn't it?"
I said, "We never saw Chrissy or Wexler again. Not even on TV. They moved out of town as soon as he got out of the hospital, together, so yeah, he was porking her."
He squinted at the sprawling skeleton of the mall and said, "This is the place."
"You think a town could have two places like this?"
I ran my hands through my hair and stared at the darkened sockets on the decomposing mall where windows should have been. I heard the faint sound of a plastic tarp snapping in the breeze somewhere. You scared, Arnie? Should I be? Is this place haunted? Nothing so simple as that. I wish it were. You say it's haunted and you picture the ghost of some old lady wandering around aimlessly. The things that come and go around here, I don't know that they were ever human. Or maybe they just don't remember it. Try to imagine a Hitler, or a Vlad the Impaler, or even the nasty old man at the dump who steals people's cats and buries them alive. Now, imagine those guys, but strip them of all their limitations. No bodies, so they never die or run down or get tired. Give them all the time in the world. Imagine that malice, that stupid, black mass of hate, drifting through eternity, just burning on and on and on like an oil well fire. Arnie waited for me to go on. I didn't. I was realizing all of a sudden how hard it was going to be to tell this next part. I thought it would feel good to unload the whole tale on somebody, but this next bit, this felt more like a confession. I got out of the car and walked toward a concrete ramp, a would-be loading dock for a stillborn mall department store. I heard Arnie's door click and thunk behind me and knew he was following. I said, "There was a girl here in town. She disappeared last year. It wasn't a big story, but you can look it up." "Let me guess, you were the last person to talk to her." I didn't answer. I climbed up the loading ramp and reached a doorway, greeted by the familiar smell of mildew and urine. I tore aside a strip of yellow warning tape and stepped into the cool darkness within. Now, this is going to sound crazy. Chapter 10. The Missing Girl. In the summer of the year after the Wexler thing, I realized someone was watching me through my television. I could sense it, the way you sense someone staring at your back, a presence behind the screen, a pair of watching eyes. I ignored it as long as I could, telling myself no one would want to secretly watch a single 23-year-old on his couch eating Taco Bell bean burritos day after day, 80 cents apiece, two and a Coke for $3. But I knew better, of course. There were apparently parties who had a very good reason to keep eyes on me at this point, aside from my perfectly sculpted statue of David Buttocks. One night, with the television on some History Channel special about history's top 10 deadliest warships or some shit, I turned away from the TV and toward the mirror on the far wall. I went to pull a brush through my knotted hair and froze. I had glimpsed the TV playing in the reflection over my shoulder. A face. It was an oddly shaped face, with features that were human, but off. A Michael Jackson face, a face like a mask. Wide, two large eyes, a nose not quite centered. Looking right at my back from the TV, plain as day. I spun on the television, the hairbrush flying from my hand, a terrorized breath sucking through my teeth. Back to normal now, the Bismarck getting sunk in a plume of smoke. Again, I suppose most people would have feared a mental illness at that point. By now, though, mental illness would just mean some tests and a prescription. Big deal. No, my fear was of somebody actually watching me through my fucking television. I told John about it, and he came right over, as a best friend would. We cursed at the television for half an hour. Then he dropped his pants and pressed his balls against the screen. Like he said, there was no need to change our routine. He suggested I get some rest, that I was stressed because of Jennifer, who had moved in and then moved back out again twice in the last 6 months. Then we drank and played PlayStation hockey until the sun came up. That became my routine for weeks after, sleeping too little and drinking too much and playing too much hockey. Things started to spin out of control. Soon we were playing without the goalies, skating 6-on-6 and scoring games 74-68. Finally, when we started both playing on the same side, Red Wings, against an inept team controlled by the computer AI and winning the games 126-0, I knew I had hit rock bottom. I also knew I was still being watched. I knew this was a bad sign, that things were moving again, that I had to get my head on straight. I threw out the bottles and shaved my face and even considered cleaning the house. I started ironing my shirts again. Somebody mailed me a little bottle of what they claimed was holy water, and I kept it on my nightstand. I hung a garage sale crucifix from my front door. Then, just after Christmas,
things got weird again. The end began when I came home from work on a frigid Friday night. I was plowing my truck through the worst winter storm the area had seen in years, the world looking like the aftermath of God's snow cone machine explosion. I pushed in through the front door, snow melting off my leather coat. A prickly fever sweat was breaking out all over me as my skin adjusted to the 50-degree temperature difference between my living room and the night air outside. The wind shifted. The whole house creaked. There was a tinkling of ice chips flicking off the windows. I had just left a nightmarish 16-hour soul-numbing double shift at Wally's video rental Orifice. The night manager had claimed she couldn't get out in the storm and asked if I could please work for her, saying that she owed me big time, and that I was such a sweetheart, and that if I ever needed anything, anything at all, just let her know. I don't think she meant that. But I put my head down and plowed through a 1,000-minute, dead-quiet, customer-free battle against exhaustion and my urge to beat my co-workers to death. Now I just wanted to dry off and curl up in... I saw something out of the corner of my eye that stopped me at mid-thought. I leaned back to see through the open door of my bedroom. The drawer on my nightstand was open. The drawer where I keep my gun. My butt cheeks clenched so tightly that not even light could have escaped. I listened for burglar sounds. Dead quiet. I took a step forward, wondering if I could fake kung fu if I had to. I once saw Arnold Schwarzenegger kill a man in a movie by grabbing his head and twisting it until the neck broke. Was that difficult? Could a man do it without a lot of practice? I keep the gun in a hollowed-out copy of the Quran that John got me for Christmas. And there the big book was, tossed on the bed, open, and gunless. Nothing else disturbed. They actually checked my Quran to see if there was a gun inside. I knew I was dealing with a sick son of a bitch. I stepped carefully and quietly through the bedroom doorway, glancing this way and that. Nobody here. I checked under the bed, the sheets still smelling faintly of girl even now, months after I'd spent my last naked night on them with Jen. Or maybe it was my imagination. Either way, you should probably change those sheets. Nothing under the bed. I checked the other rooms in the dark little house, stepping slowly across the carpet. Somebody had called, I noticed, the little red new message light on my answering machine blinking in the darkness like a time bomb. Nobody here. I wandered toward the answering machine, my gut full of snakes. Snow melted in my hair, a droplet of ice water running into my ear. I reached up to brush it back and sucked in a shocked breath. I had found the pistol. It was in my motherfucking hand. I dropped the gun like it was made of bees. It bounced onto the sofa, and I stared stupidly at it. Then stared even more stupidly at my empty palm, fingers pink from the cold. What the? Now that you ask, it's a whole 10-foot walk from your heated truck to your front door. Why does every inch of exposed skin feel windburned? Why do you seem to have a pint of snow in your hair? There's that feeling again, that fluttery feeling of mental weightlessness. Like the times when you wake up in the dark, on the hood of a car, a bottle in your hand, no idea what day it is, some girl shouting at you in Arabic. I tried to collect myself. Tired. Tired like a zombie. An overworked zombie. One who got hired as a salaried assistant manager at a zombie video store. Only to find out salary just means he doesn't get paid for overtime. My skull pounded. My knees were ground glass. I sat heavily on the sofa and stared vacantly at the little beads of water standing on the sleek chrome surface of the Smith. I glanced at my watch. Right after midnight. Okay, you got off at 11. You came straight home. It's a 12-minute drive, figure maybe 20 for the weather. You came right in. So where did the other half hour go, Dave? Did you maybe take a detour and shoot your boss? No. If I'd shot Wally's manager, Fred Wolfleg, I wouldn't have deprived myself by repressing the memory, would I? I picked up the gun and ejected the magazine, still heavy with bullets. I sighed with relief. If I had indeed stopped by Jeff's house to murder him, I would have emptied the gun. I reinserted the magazine. This was no way to start the weekend. I punched the play button on the machine, listened to the message. It was John. It finished. I hit play again, listened closer, then hit play again. By the fourth time, I was pretty sure that John had said, "Bag full of fat." I decided to try once more. Beep! Dave! It's me. Amy's missing.
and we got what looks like a bag full of fat here. It's weird. And I mean bad weird, not clown weird. It's almost midnight, and I guess you're not home yet. Or maybe you're in bed. You're not in bed, are you? I know you haven't been sleeping. Are you there? Wake up, David. Wake up. Okay, so you're not there. Call me when you get this. I don't care how late. Oh, and when you come over, watch out for a jellyfish. See ya. Beep. Bag full of fat. I picked up the phone and dialed John on his cell. One ring, and then, I told you to leave me the fuck alone, Vinny. John? Oh, Dave, sorry. I'd just been having a heated argument here on my phone, and then I hung up in disgust. Then when the phone rang, I just assumed, without checking, that it was the person I was having an argument with, so I just blindly shouted insults into the phone. How embarrassing. I'm getting sick of that one, John. Are you on your way over? I got something going on here. What's your thing? I paused, made a decision. Batch of brownies in the oven. I don't want them to burn, or else they get gummy. Yeah, they'll stick, too. Did you grease the pan? Yeah. Good. Anyway, Amy is missing, and the scene is weird as shit. The situation has a real Lovecraft feel to it. Though, you know, if you come over, it'll be more of an Anne Rice situation. If you know what I mean. Because you're gay. Who's missing, John? Amy, Dave. A-M-Y. I think my signal's breaking up. I don't know any. Amy Sullivan, Big Jim's sister? That stopped me. Memories of an entire day spent locked in the back of a truck, sick with fear and boredom. A promise made to a dead man. I hadn't thought of that day in months. Oh, you mean cucumber? Do you not feel the need to learn people's real names, Dave? We called her that in school. She was in that special ed class, always throwing up for some reason. A silent pause on John's end. You know, like a sea cucumber? There are these eels that... Anyway, Dave, we're at her house now. The cops, too. How soon can you be here? How about June? Even that wasn't going to be enough time to piece this together. I pictured Big Jim on his back, a crimson stain across his neck and the floor like a scarf. The dead man had circled back into my life somehow. I glanced at the gun, trying to make it all fit, and failing. What'd you say on my machine? Bag full of... I can't hear you. You're breaking up. Just get here as soon as you can. We gotta go deal with this flying jellyfish thing. A pause on my end now. What? See you in a few... No, under the cabinet. No. The cabinet. That... Here. Let me... Click. Doop. I disconnected and did what I usually do after hanging up with John. Sat in dumbfounded silence and contemplated all of the poor choices in my life. I shrugged out of my coat, pulled off my Wally shirt, smelled it, then hung it back in the bedroom closet. As I pulled on a new shirt, I grabbed a bottle of caffeine pills from my desk drawer. I washed down four of them with a warm, half-empty bottle of Red Mountain Dew I found on the kitchen counter. I pulled on the coat and, after a moment's hesitation, dropped the Smith & Wesson in the pocket, the weight pulling the whole left side of the coat down on my shoulder. I felt like Bruce Willis. Is it me? Or is the barrel slightly warm? I pushed through my front door and plunged into the cold, but made it no farther than the doormat. Footprints. The thin blanket of white across my front lawn should have been clean, save for a single trail of prints from the driver's side of my Bronco to the spot where I was standing. Instead, there was a haphazard circle of tracks in loops around my front yard, then trailing off around the back of the house. The trail of prints emerged from the other side and eventually led to the front porch, where I was now. I stepped off the porch and into the crunchy snow ice shell that coated the ground. I leaned down, squinting against the storm. Boot prints. Zigzag treads. I had a very dark, very lonely realization. The prints were mine. All of them. I glanced around in the darkness, seeing nothing but sparkling flecks of ice passing through shafts of streetlight. I made the silent decision to never tell anyone about this, and got in my truck. Missing time, that's what they call it. John's got a missing girl, you've got a missing half hour. Shit. I twisted the ignition to life, thought for a moment, then pulled the Smith from my pocket. I pressed the button on the handle and again popped out the magazine.
I made a little pouch in my lap with my shirt and with my thumb flicked out the bullets one by one. I counted as I went, hoping, no, praying, that none were missing. 1, 2, 3, 4. The bullets were, unusual. The heads were silver with a bright green plastic tip. A guy had mailed me these anonymously. They were lined up in rows in a heavy white cardboard box, a tag on the inside typed with bullet jargon I didn't understand. Something about proximity fuses and long serial numbers. John and I test-fired them, shot a pumpkin and watched it explode into flaming bits of blackened shell. 7, 8, 9. That's what people do these days. They mail me things. Crystals, shrunken heads, doctored pictures of angels in clouds and of bleeding statues. Bundles of blue-lined notebook paper full of scrawled, rambly stories about Satan sending hidden messages through mass email subject lines. I've gotten chunks of stone stolen from haunted castles in Scotland, hunks of supposedly cursed black volcanic rock from Hawaii, dried Bigfoot turds. John and I have this reputation now, and everybody wants to help. 13, 14. I let out a long breath. 1 missing. 1. The two-story, psycho-style house Big Jim Sullivan had lived in with his mentally handicapped sister would have cost most of $1 million had it not been run down and located in a weedy, desolate section of town, a block from a chemical drain cleaner factory. I guess the sister, Amy, lived here by herself now that Big Jim was deceased under circumstances I am rarely able to adequately explain in mixed company. I swung my headlights into the yard of the Sullivan psycho house, between John's 1978 Caddy, bearing the cryptic license plate CRKHTLR, and an undisclosed cop car that was parked along the road. It really was a shitty, shitty neighborhood. The next house over looked empty. The neighbor down the hill on the other side was an expanse of white parking lot dense with a wormy pattern of tire treads. It led to the ass of a huge building lined with a row of roll-up garage doors. The rear trucking entrance of the drain router plant. There was a single semi backed into one of the stalls bearing the logo of a cartoon plumber with a big red X through him. I wondered if the bathroom drains at the plant ever got clogged to the point that they had to call in a plumber, and, if so, if anyone was able to make eye contact with the guy while he was there. Through my windshield, I saw two figures in the front yard. One was John, arms jammed in his pockets, the stiff breeze sucking away cigarette smoke in a horizontal stream. The other was a bear of a man who I recognized as John's Uncle Drake, still the only cop in town with whom we were on a first-name basis. Drake spoke. John nodded, the ember of his cigarette bobbing slightly in the darkness. John was growing a beard. He had been working construction off and on after having been fired from Wally's a year before. He had gotten caught bootlegging DVDs and giving them away to customers right there at the store. Not selling them, mind you. Giving them away. I climbed out and was immediately assaulted by the freezing wind. The looming house didn't just look empty. It looked abandoned. It had gone downhill since I had last seen it on the night I tried to return Molly. Peeling paint, filthy windows, no tire tracks in the driveway. Big Jim had looked after Amy in the years since their parents died, but I don't know who was looking after her now. Apparently nobody, since she was lost and all. Man, it was cold. Drake looked shabbier than I did. The man inflated in full cop uniform and parka, complete with one of those navy blue fur earflap hats, the blue blimp of weariness. "Wong," he said, with a lack of enthusiasm usually reserved for door-to-door Mormons. "I don't enjoy our little encounters either, Drake, but here we are, just the same." "How long's she been missing?"
"Don't know. Neighbors saw her dog walking around the neighborhood this afternoon. They tried to return her, and couldn't get anybody at the door. I came by and saw the..."
A skipped beat. A quick glance at John.
I thought you guys might know something."
"Tell him about your missing half hour." I pushed that thought from my head and pretended it had never been there. Besides, I knew exactly where I had been during my missing time, walking around and around my yard in circles, right? Perfect sense. John flicked away his cigarette and crunched toward the front door. "Drake is going to see if Amy is at a friend's house. She knows the Hoaglands, so he figures maybe she got scared off by the, The two of them shared a second let's-not-discuss-this-now glance. Opening the door to his cruiser, Drake said,
"You find anything, you call my cell, right?
then I handle it. Making it clear that we weren't cops, that a missing person was still a cop thing no matter what weird acidness lurked inside this house. John tipped a finger at him and said,
Yep, thanks for calling us, Drake. You're the kind of man a man wants when a man wants a man.
Just inside the door was a little entrance hall with a black and white tiled floor, like a chessboard. There was a plate-sized chunk of tile missing near the wall, and the bare wood had been painted in it to match the pattern with what looked like magic marker and whiteout. I glanced into the kitchen. I froze. Molly? No question it was her. A red Labrador whatever, fast asleep on the linoleum. I had the same thought from when we glimpsed her outside the abandoned mall that night. No way, just another dog of the same breed, surely.
Oh, that's her, said John. Go look at the collar, got the address on there and everything.
But how?
Don't know. She answers to Molly, though, or at least as well as she ever did.
I wanted to go look closer, but I admit I was afraid to. Something coming back from the dead was almost always bad news. Movies taught me that. For every one Jesus, you get a million zombies.
So the dog we saw explode, that wasn't Molly?
Don't know.
Or maybe that was Molly, and this is, what, an imposter?
He shrugged.
You should have seen me when I saw her here. I freaked out.
You think she's responsible for what happened to Amy? Maybe she, I don't know, ate her.
Withhold judgment until you see the jellyfish.
I didn't ask. I reluctantly turned my back on the resurrected dog, and we pushed through a living room with a green couch that looked to be from 1905. Up a stairway, into a darkened hall. There was an unlit light fixture on the ceiling and one of those old brass switchblades on the wall, the kind with the black buttons. I punched the top button. Nothing happened. John stepped carefully down the hall, squinting into the darkness. He turned and said,
No, that doesn't do anything. Hand me the flashlight.
You didn't tell me to bring a... He held a hand out to shush me and ducked into a side door. We both stepped into a large room that, in the dim glow from the window, looked like a library of shelves, mostly filled with odd, shadowy shapes that were not books. I saw what looked like a bundle of cobweb hanging from the ceiling, and reached out to brush it aside. Pop! A shower of blue sparks flashlit the room. A bone-rattling electric sting flared up my elbow. The fixture on the ceiling blinked once, twice, and then bathed the room in light. About a foot in front of me was what looked like a bundle of wet string, suspended in the air by nothing at all. It didn't look so much like a jellyfish as a man-o'-war, the slimy things that float lazily on the ocean surface and let their stringy tentacles hang down in the water. The creature drifted slowly up to the ceiling, toward the light. It wrapped its tentacles around the fixture and, to our utter astonishment, began frantically humping it like a puppy on a bunny slipper. The lights dimmed, finally flickering out to darkness again. The room was silent except for the soft rattling of glass vibrating against metal with each of the creature's spastic thrusts.
You ever seen one of those before?
John whispered somewhere in the darkness. Above us, a little blue spark jumped off one noodly tentacle to another with a soft fzz sound. I like to think I would have mentioned it if I had.
Uncle Drake shot it. Didn't seem to bother it much.
He could see it?
Yeah. It's real.
So that put it in the category of the mutants at the mall, and not the wig monsters and shadow people. I'd have to make a spreadsheet somewhere to keep track. And don't forget, just because Drake can see it doesn't mean another stranger from around town would. Lots of chances for a cop to get infected in this town. Ask Morgan Freeman. Now there was another train of thought badly in need of derailing. I said, You got your lighter? John flicked his Zippo and cast a pool of weak yellowy light around us. I glanced around, saw that only a couple of the shelves contained books, worn paperbacks with white fold lines. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, somebody named Terry Pratchett, Babylon 5 novelizations, the first, third, and fourth Harry Potter novels. Jim must have figured three was the most he could allow without risking turning Amy to witchcraft. The rest of the shelves were crammed with stuffed animals and junk. I saw a row of plates on little wire stands painted with the faces of Star Trek characters. The creature on the ceiling didn't react. Well, I said, letting out a tired breath, I was hoping it would attack your hand. I guess it's the electricity it likes and not the light.
John slapped off the lighter and said, I thought about opening a window and just shooing it outside.
That doesn't seem like such a good idea.
I thought for a moment, wondering vaguely if I had remembered to turn on the porch light back home.
Can it, like, pass through walls?
It hasn't yet.
Follow me.
We stepped out into the hall and I closed the door behind us.
Okay, I said, as long as nobody ever opens that door.
Right. We'll put a sign on it or something, John said, the first problem solved. The weird thing is down here. Check this shit.
We went across the hall and he gestured into an ancient bathroom, complete with enormous cast-iron tub and a yellowing vanity with a cracked mirror. A steady stream of drips plunked from the faucet. A pair of scissors were wedged under one of the knobs, presumably to keep the valve from running freely. He punched the switch and the light flickered on, this one apparently unmolested. On the floor was what looked like a clear plastic bag filled with a marbled pink and yellow substance about the size of one of those giant bags of dog food. There was writing on the side in an odd angular font. John said,
That lock was bolted from inside. We had to jimmy it to get it in here. Water was running in the sink, toothbrush laying on the counter with dried toothpaste on it. That window is painted shut, so there was no way out of the room. So she was in here, and then she wasn't. She never left the room, right?
The lock was one of those little slide bolts like you'd see on old public toilet stalls. The jimmy of the lock had been accomplished by smacking the door, probably with their shoulders, until the little metal loop on the doorframe popped out of its screw holes. I leaned over and inspected the window. It looked to have been sealed long before I was born, not that it made a difference. Even if Amy had locked the door and crawled out of the window for some reason, dropping 15 feet or so to the ice below, how would she have gotten the window shut behind her?
Can you think of a way that somebody could get that door locked from the other side? Like if they snatched her and then slid the bolt closed behind them?
What you're asking, said the irritating voice in my head, is whether or not you could have done it, Dave.
Bullshit, forget that.
I was sure my bout of missing time, during which a bullet had left my gun, had nothing to do with this person who suddenly went missing on the same day. Two completely separate events. In fact, the event I was repressing was probably Amy coming to my house to borrow a bullet, and me calmly handing it to her.
Sure, said John. You could probably get the bolt slid in there with the door closed, give a guy 20 minutes, a bent wire coat hanger, let him try about 40 times. What would be the point, though? Just to mess with us?
I nudged the bag on the floor with my foot. Dense liquid, a bag of sludge. He said,
The writing on the bag, that's a weight, right?
I guess. I leaned down. 44.42 kilograms. I scratched my head.
I give up.
You, think that's her? In the bag?
Ew! No, let's assume not for now. That's just gross.
You think the jellyfish ate her?
Bones and all?
We're talking about a tentacled flying lamp fucker, Dave. What are you prepared to call unlikely?
I stepped out of the bathroom and wandered down the hall, passing a room stacked with cardboard boxes and some broken chairs. There was another door that had been nailed shut that seemed to lead out into midair.
John said, You know what that is? They used to build these old houses with doors that just led to a big drop to fool burglars. They'd labeled that door Treasury or something like that. The guy busts in through the door and finds himself falling straight down. They'd put spikes or something down there. They used to call it an Irish elevator.
Or, John, they tore a balcony off here years ago and just never bothered to take out the door.
We passed a bare guest room that smelled of dust and old varnish. Then at the end of the hall came to a door standing open with a band poster stuck to the inside, a group called VNV Nation. I leaned into a chaotic bedroom, crammed with furniture and carpeted with wrinkly clothes. Posters on every wall, bands I'd never heard of, and one of a shiny Angelina Jolie as the Tomb Raider. There was a very nice laptop computer, a Mac, propped up on a pillow on an unmade bed.
The computer, I asked. Was it like that when you got here?
Yeah, we didn't touch a thing.
On a nightstand off the bed, there were 4 empty plastic bottles with orange juice labels and a half a dozen brown prescription bottles. There was a box of Fruit Loops on the floor, open. I saw all this from the doorway, but didn't step inside.
I felt dirty for just peeking my head in, invading this person's space. John pushed past me, though, and I realized we probably didn't have a choice if we were serious about this. Cops do this every day, rifling closets and digging through your dildo drawer. I noticed the bed laptop was on, ironically in sleep mode, a single power light glowing along one side. I tapped the space bar, the screen fading up from black to reveal a white screen with blue text scrolling down.
Check it out.
John nodded his head toward a dresser, one drawer half open, a couple of bras trying to escape. Atop the dresser sat a little black object, round and not much bigger than a roll of film, a lens in the center.
A camera, I noted. It's one of those wireless camera deals, he said. For the computer.
What, like a webcam?
Yeah, or something.
Was this Jim's old room? I asked, for some reason having trouble picturing Amy Cucumber Sullivan knowing how to shop for and use computer gadgetry. Before I encountered her while trying to return Molly a few years before, my only memory of Amy was from the life skills class at the Pineview Alternative School for Mentally Fucked Students, where I had spent my senior year. She always had her head down on her desk, asleep. To me, just a mop of red hair spilling over bony forearms. I think I only heard her say a dozen words my whole time there, and most of them were, "Please move or I'm going to puke on you."
John muttered, "Dunno," in the way that people do when you ask a useless question that deserves nothing more.
I glanced around and saw a second camera, a square one, sitting atop a shelf on a department store's sort of wood computer desk across the room. It wasn't aimed at the chair in front of it like you'd think a webcam would be, but sideways, toward the hole. "This camera is aimed over at the door," I deduced. I looked up and saw a ceiling fan with a set of four little canister lights aimed around the room. Taped to one canister was another of the wireless cameras. "And another one," I said, "aimed right at the window, all the entryways covered like a security system." A little tingle of nervousness rose in my gut for reasons I couldn't wrap my sluggish brain around.
"Okay," John said, moving toward the laptop. "You know, I just thought about something. Why would she lock her bathroom at all if she lived here alone? You'd just poop with the door open, right?"
I nodded and said, "So maybe she was already scared. If this were an episode of Law and Order, we'd have a nice shot of her getting abducted right on camera. And yes, before you give me that look of yours, I do realize whatever happened, happened in the bathroom and not in here. She didn't have a webcam in her bathroom, did she?"
"I want you to think about what you just asked."
John picked up the laptop and sat down with it in the computer chair. "Well," I said, "she could have caught somebody in the hall." That feeling again. It was like a faint alarm on the back of my skull, like the creeping sense that you've left something important at the house just as you're leaving for vacation. "He's going to look for the webcam stills on there."
"So?"
I shoved my hands in my pockets and wandered around the room, wondering how our getting first look at the evidence would fuck up a prosecution should this turn out to be a run-of-the-mill kidnapping and murder, flying jellyfish notwithstanding. Welcome to Undisclosed. I fingered a loose key in my pocket that had apparently fallen off the key ring. I ran my other hand through my hair, which was drying in a mushrooming carrot-top spray. I said, "Is there any place open in town that sells that red Mountain Dew? I had some today. It's like somebody melted a box of cherry Jolly Ranchers and stirred in some crack cocaine. Is that one convenience store on Lexington a 24-hour deal?" John wasn't listening. He was studying the flat monitor on the laptop. "For the webcam stills, to see who took Amy." My mouth was going dry, my heart thumping just a little too fast. The caffeine, probably. I leaned over John's shoulder and saw the phrase, "My cat peed on my bed," at the top of the screen. It was a series of broken lines, each beginning with a name in brackets. I knew the format.
"That's a chat log. She was on there when she got up to brush her teeth. Then somebody took her, maybe somebody or maybe some thing. But the key is she knew they were coming somehow. She knew because she set up the camera so she would have Oh, shit.
I stood bolt upright.
"What are you going to say if that's you on the camera, asshole?"
That thought, like a hammer to the balls. John actually glanced over to me, and I suddenly felt naked. I tried to remember what my body language looked like when I was at my most casual and innocent. Then the whole effect was ruined when I pulled my other hand from my pocket and saw what I was holding. It was the key to the tool shed,
in my backyard. I normally keep it on a nail near my back door. I do not normally keep it in my pocket.
Oh, what did you put in the tool shed, Dave?
I held up a declaratory, "I've got an idea" finger and said, "Wait." John turned to me, his sudden attention like a heat lamp on my face. I realized I had absolutely no idea what I was going to say next. We shouldn't do that yet.
Okay. Why?
Because, I think it would be better if... Look, we have one witness to this thing, right?
We do?
Yeah. The thing, the jellyfish thing. I mean, we're up here dicking around with computers, and that thing could take off in the meantime, go back to wherever it goes. The computer isn't going anywhere.
John glanced into the hallway and said, "You think it talks?"
I looked him straight in the eye and said, "I think you can make it talk, whether it wants to or not." He scratched his chin thoughtfully and said,
"I'll need a toaster."
"I saw one in the kitchen. Here, hand me the laptop. You go beat some information out of that slimy bastard." John strode out of the room with newfound purpose. I took his seat. The desktop wallpaper on the laptop was a photo of Orlando Bloom in full Lord of the Rings costume. I waited until I heard John's footsteps clomping down the stairs before I started clicking through folders, as fast as my fingers would go. Sweating a little now, my heart thumping against bone, my knee bouncing. I eventually stumbled across a folder full of little icons that came up as grainy camera stills. I clicked on one, saw a dim image of a lump sleeping soundly under the covers of the bed. Another, the same thing. A third, a shot of an empty bed. A fourth, the lump again. There were hundreds. I heard John stomp back up the stairs and I glanced toward the hall, not returning to my task until I heard him open the library door. I was stuck. Deleting the pictures was out of the question. I was not covering up a crime here, and at that point I fully intended to tell John if it somehow turned out I was the culprit we were after. But I wanted him to find out my way. I needed time to figure it out, to process it, to have some control over the revelation. I needed options. I cut the whole folder of pics and moved them to the most obscure location on the hard drive I could find, inside a subfolder of a subfolder of a subfolder of a subfolder of printer drivers. I closed up the computer and leapt up out of the chair, suddenly a bundle of nervous energy.
"You've got to get home. You've got to see what's in that tool shed."
Yes, that was right. I plunged a hand into my pocket and clutched my car key so tightly they etched marks in my palm. I strode out and down the hall, feeling a cloud of guilt around me like a stench. I passed the library just as John came flying out, slamming the door behind him. He said,
"That dangly bastard knows something. I can read it in his body language."
I said, "I have to go."
"Why?"
"I just have to run home. I'll be back."
"Yeah. You probably gotta check on the brownies. Can you get me some rubber gloves while you're at it?"
"Okay."
He opened the library door again and said, "Where'd you go, asshole?"
Then once more closed himself inside the room. I fled. Driving again. Defrost heat blowing on the windshield, ice crystals melting on contact with the glass, swept aside by the wiper blade a second later. Wheels floating under me, no traction in the ice. The roads, all to myself.
"If there's a body in your tool shed, say, of a skinny, retarded, red-headed girl, just come clean. To John first. Tell him exactly what happened. No need to plan beyond that. Gotta see what's there first. Gotta see."
I turned on the radio, looking for something to blast the thoughts out of my head, hoping the moist nighttime air would blow a rare non-country station. I ground through static and static and static, then recoiled at the shrill, choking sound of a man apparently squealing through a crushed larynx. After a moment, I realized it was simply Fred Durst and the group Limp Bizkit, Shitload's favorite band. They're the ones who invented the musical technique of feeding a list of generic rap phrases to a goat, then reading its turds into a microphone over heavy metal guitar. This was the song Rollin', judging by the fact that the chorus was Fred saying the word several dozen times. Perfect. Rollin', rollin', rollin'. Just tell the truth. That's all I had to do. Just tell the truth. If I did it, I did it. I blanked and found a dead girl. No cover-up, no hiding the body or any of that. Just face the consequences.
Sure. Your dad will fly up and he'll tell you not to talk to anybody. And he'll make noise about your record of mental illness and use lots of big words. You'll get off because he's damn good at getting people off.
And instead of jail, you'll get a stay in an institution smelling of ammonia and spoiled food, surrounded by people mumbling to themselves and smearing feces on the walls. It will work. It worked for the Hitchcock thing. No, don't think about that. Keep rolling.